I wanted to talk about this topic because I see a lot of kids. I just edited clinics in podiatric medicine and surgery on pediatrics, so I have a kind of a high base of pediatrics in my practice. And I've coached a lot of teams. I have four boys, so I've coached a lot of sports teams over the years. And so Seaver's disease is something I've ended up seeing quite a bit of over my career. And the thing about Seaver's disease is I think we underappreciate the impact it has on the quality of life of the child. And I stumbled across a really nice series of articles that were out of Australia. And the first article is kind of a literature review. The second one was about the quality of life in Seaver's disease. And then the third was looking at risk factors prospectively. They used the data for the first and, or the second and third was the same data group for the study, so the numbers are the same as far as participants. Historically, Seaver's disease was actually described by Haglund, and then Seaver later wrote about it in 1912. It's an inflammation of the calcaneal hypothesis, often called attraction epiphysitis. You know, typically when we think of Seaver's disease, we think of that 10 to 12 year old boy who plays sports. It's just at the start of a sports season like baseball or basketball. They go through a growth spurt and they have pain over one or both heels. And that's just kind of inherently how you think of Seaver's disease. And you also think, they probably have equinus, some sort of biomechanical problem like pronation. And then activity worsens it and can actually cause lumping. The problem with that, it's all anecdotal and observational findings. There's very little retrospective or prospective analysis. Most of it's been retrospective data. So their first article from the Australian group, if you look at the ratio, again, mostly male versus female, bilateral, it has a fair amount of bilaterality. And then the age, if you look at these various studies through the literature, you can see the age, again, range from that 10 to 12-year-old group. So this is kind of a review of the literature for those factors. There was actually some question, does Seaver's disease really exist? Is it something else? This article was over almost 26,000 patients. The problem was it was basically just radiographs. To make a conclusion, there was no details of the sample size, whether the patients were symptomatic or not. And there's a lot of people doing the review, so there's inter-rater reliability issues with the study. So this study questioned the existence of Seaver's disease, but really it's been shot down because of several problems within the study. Brower also wrote an article attributing heel pain to plantar fasciitis, Achilles tendonitis, and retrocalcaneal exostosis. I think when you think of that inherently, you know that kids just don't get those things. I mean, kids don't get plantar fasciitis. Kids rarely get Achilles tendonitis, but they do get that, and they hardly ever see a retrocalcaneal heel spur on a child. And this was just based on radiographic findings, basically, also. And then Ogden looked at another study, looked at 14 kids who didn't respond to, who had heel pain that didn't respond to conservative care. They were immobilized, and they had an MRI before and after. And basically, they showed bony bruising in the metaphysis of the calcaneus with no change in the apophysis. The problem was there's really no other literature to support that as a diagnostic feature, and the only person who's ever written about it is Ogden. So there was some possibility of bias towards this diagnosis. So because he's the only one that's ever said that this could be due to apophysitis, bony bruising in the metaphysis as opposed to apophysis causing heel pain, that article's also kind of been shot down. When you talk about the incidence of Seaver's disease, basically, it ranges from 2% at the lowest to about 16%. Most of these studies are retrospective. Most of them have also taken place in sports medicine clinics as opposed to a general clinic. So there is a little bit of variance or how reliable that incidence study is, but they accepted this between 2 and 16% in most of the articles out there. We talk about the pathophysiology of Seaver's disease. It's a secondary bony growth center, or epiphysis. It's open in girls about age 5 and boys 7 to 8, and then it fuses in girls around 13 and boys around 15 years of age. Proximal to the epiphysis is the apophysis, which is where the Achilles tendon actually inserts. It has a slower growth plate. The problem with this whole anatomical area is there's a lot of stress both from the plantar fascia and the Achilles tendon on this area. And that's really where it comes down to a lot of the problems with this condition. One of the pathophysiology considerations is overuse due to repetitive microtrauma causing traction on the apophysis, particularly with sports like running or jumping. So it's been well documented in the literature. Lieberson, they did a paper where they looked at limbs from accidents. They didn't have any history whether the patient had Sievers disease or not. But what they saw in this age group of 10 to 12, they saw a lot of fibrous bands in the cartilage perpendicular to the os calcaneus via histological and CT studies. And what they gleaned from that was there's a lot of stress and remodeling process going on in the calcaneus in that age group, leading to suggest a traction stress argument. Inflammation has also been brought up in several articles, but the problem with inflammation theory is that it's based all on radiographs and the fragmentation of the apophysis and being an increased density. But when you really look at the literature, there's no substantial evidence for the presence of an inflammatory process through either histologic or radiologic means. So what about the pathomechanics? Probably the most accepted and the one that I think is most accurate is growth spurt. Basically, muscles grow slower than bone development. So you get a kid that's growing quickly, their bones are growing quicker. That's why you see, we're going to talk about Aquinas in a minute, but that's why you see Aquinas-related component of this. And it's unusual for a kid not to have Aquinas and all of a sudden have Aquinas and a sore heel. Why is that? It's because their muscles are growing slower than the bones. As far as the Achilles tendon increasing traction on the apophysis, there's been a lot of studies with varied results. Part of that is the problem with Aquinas itself, the definition, how it's measured, inter-rater reliability. There was a study in Chapman in 2011 where they did show 100% of patients, 22 of 22 children, had bilateral gastroc Aquinas in the Sievers disease group, and only three in the control group had Aquinas. So that study has, I think, validated the component of Aquinas as the pathomechanic factor. As far as biomechanical malalignment, there's really no evidence-based medicine to support this. In fact, both types of feet that we see, pronated or supinated, have been described in the literature by several authors. Trauma, infection, and then weight, BMI, has also been considered a factor. This is actually a different study. I'm going to step outside that group of three from Australia. This is from Sweden. That was in Chapman 2013, and they looked at some of the diagnostic factors. And their study was a case-controlled matched study. So they had 30 in their symptomatic group and 15 in their control group, and they were age and sex matched. So you can see the age, again, that 10 to 12-year range. Their weight was very similar. The sports activity, all the sports involved ball-type sports. And you can see left foot versus right foot, and then bilateral was more than half. And pain duration was between 34, or throughout 34 weeks or so. The activity level scale that they used, this index, or the Swedish index, basically E is the highest level of activity possible, something where you're breaking sweat every day and you're going to exhaustion almost every day. So kids who are playing high-level sports. Some general findings from the results, 50% experienced pain for more than 6 months, which I think is it's a long time for a kid to be hobbling around with a sore heel. 57% reduced sports activities due to pain, and then 43% of those patients continued playing sports with the pain. And none of the patients increased their activity level, and their average pain was 7 out of 10 on the pain scale. Some of the examinations that they used, first was the barefoot standing on one heel, which is right here. This is direct palpation. And then the one that we commonly use, the side-to-side squeeze test. So they looked at how reliable those tests were in diagnosing those. They also looked at radiographs, lateral radiographs of the patients. They looked at fragmentation. They looked at how many fragments there were. They looked at density of the apophysis. And they looked at the distal fragment, which is what they're calling this, and this right here. So you can see, for example, this has three fragments. This one has two. And they compared density, so they have radiologists do this part of it. As far as the reliability, sensitivity, and specificity, there's a break down into different things they looked at: pain on one leg, heel standing, the squeeze test, the palpation, sclerosis. Fragmentation basically was 87% sensitive and 47% specificity. And distal fragment, not a whole lot of difference, 70% to 53%. Pain with one leg standing was 100%, and pain with the squeeze test side to side was 97%, and palpation was a little less reliable, 80%. This is actually a breakdown chart from their study. So if you look at the control group, that, again, 30 patients in the Sievers disease group, 100% had pain with one leg heel standing. And I had never really used this as a diagnostic factor until I read this article. So if you have the kids stand on one leg with no shoe, with their weight back on their heel, they'll have to support themselves against something so they don't fall over. But that's 100% diagnostic in the study. And the squeeze test, which is what's typically written about, was 97% diagnostic, and pain on palpation was only 87%. You can see the sclerosis was evident on both groups. So, again, this just kind of reaffirms what we know. Radiographs are not the way we diagnose Sievers disease. There's fragmentation on both sides, a number of fragments, and then whether or not there was a distal fragment. When you talk about treatment, there's been a lot of articles that talk about a lot of different types of treatments for Sievers disease. And this is just sort of a number of articles per type of treatment over the years. This one down here, whoever wrote that article should be put in jail, I think, because I don't know why you'd ever do that. Anyway, one of the things I really try to do is to try to stop, you know, not prevent the kids from playing sports. Because let's face it, if you're a 10, 11, 12-year-old boy, the most important thing in the world to you is the sport you're playing. I mean, everything else comes second, or a girl for that matter. So I try to get a lot of kids to continue to play. When they did their quality of life study, they looked at four different questionnaires as possibility. Basically, they went to the Pediatric Orthopedic Society of North America to pose this questionnaire as the one they chose. There's a breakdown of the different components of the different questionnaires they considered. On the POSE note, quality of life questionnaire, they only used four of the eight scales because four of them applied to upper extremity findings. So they looked at satisfaction with current symptoms, pain comfort scale, happiness scale, sports and physical functioning scale. Those are the four components they used. Again, the summary of the age, again, that 10 to 12-year-old range. It's just a graph of the breakdown. Again, you can see, again, the clustering of the patients in that 10 to 12-year-old range. Male versus female. So here's the Sievers side right here. Female versus male, much higher in the male side versus the control group, a little more even. So when you talk about the quality of life, what leads to higher quality of life? So for a worse quality of life, the first number, if it's lower, and the second number, these second, third, and fourth findings should be higher. That would equate to a lower quality of life. So satisfaction was much higher in the non-Sievers disease or the control group. Happiness scale, sports physical function scale, and pain comfort scale was higher in the symptomatic group, indicating a lower quality of life. All three of those equate to a lower quality of life. Again, they had 67 patients in the Sievers disease group and 236 in the non-Sievers group. So they're finding there's a significant difference detected between the two groups, suggesting that Sievers disease has a real and tangible effect on the patient's quality of life and should be treated as efficiently and effectively as possible. So like I said, when you're a 10 or 11 or 12-year-old boy or girl who loves sports, and you can't play because your heel hurts, that really affects your quality of life. Then they looked at the risk factors in their third study. Again, they used that same data group. You know, the distribution was unilateral 44% of the time, bilateral 55% of the time. And they did look at the alignment of the forefoot, rear foot alignment. You can see the breakdown there. They looked at the foot position index, the forefoot position, ankle joint dorsiflexion, the BMI, and the absolute difference between the resting calcaneal stance position and the neutral calcaneal stance position, and then their total activity in hours. And there's a breakdown between the Sievers disease group and non-Sievers disease group. One of the things that they used to measure, how they measured, was this commonly used device. They've done in some Aquinas studies in Australia. It's called a Lincomb template. You know, they validated it in some of their studies. I question how valid it is because it doesn't really lock the subtalar joint into neutral position. So I do think you're getting some dorsiflexion through the metatarsal joints. I don't know how really reliable it is, honestly. But here are a breakdown of some of the right and left side data. So really, the big thing was the forefoot position on the left side and the forefoot position on the right side were statistically significant. And then slightly significant was left ankle joint dorsiflexion. The rest of the stuff was not statistically significant. And they also looked at the type of sport. Was there a type of sport that was more inclined to having Seaver's disease versus other sports? And they looked at the Seaver's disease group and the non-Seaver's disease group. This is Australian rules football, which is basically rugby. So a lot higher percent of the Seaver's disease group kids played that versus the non-Seaver's disease group. Basketball was the other big factor comparing the two groups. And then as far as not getting Seaver's disease group, kids who just did schoolyard games were much higher in the non-Seaver's disease group than the Seaver's disease group. So again, what they showed was no evidence to support weight, activity levels as risk factors for Seaver's disease. There was a slight statistically significant for left side ankle joint dorsiflexion, but forefoot and rear foot malalignment, stronger odds ratio. So there was a biomechanical factor is what they did find. So what do I think? I think the diagnosis is clinical. And one of the things that I've started doing is the one-leg heel standing test as well as the squeeze test to diagnose it. There's no diagnostic value in x-rays other than to rule out any kind of cystic lesion in the calcaneus or other pathology. I do think that they should be done on an initial exam. I think we have to consider the quality of life impact on the child. I think that's important. Another important factor when you're discussing your treatment is to not allow the parents to dictate the activity level. You get the gung-ho dad who's the coach and wants Johnny to keep playing football, and Johnny's hobbling around on one leg. That's not in Johnny's best interest if he's not getting better. So don't allow the parents to try to sort of dictate or push you into a sort of treatment pathway you don't want to go through. I use steroids on kids. I have no hesitancy at all to use steroids on kids. I use a metal dose pack a lot. In fact, I sometimes will do more than one round with them. I stretch them. I think that's important. I usually start off, I think shock absorption is helpful. I use a Thule heel cup. It's a waffle cone, kind of rubber heel cup. Ice, rest. I really try to avoid sports cessation. Again, it gets into the quality of life issue with the child. If the heel cups aren't enough, I'll go to a custom orthoses. And then finally, if we go to immobilization, obviously they're going to have to stop playing the sport that they're involved in. If things are not resolving, you need to consider your diagnosis. You may have an incorrect diagnosis, so you may have to go back and look at some x-rays and make sure there's no kind of cyst or anything in the calcaneus or kind of a bone lesion or something else going on. Any questions?